There's a bit more detail on the web than in my lecture notes anyway, okay? All right, so let's start. Last lecture we started with electromagnetism, electrostatics, and I went through that quickly. I'm going to revise that now and hopefully go a bit further. The main point we're going to broach in this lecture is electromagnetic shielding. Okay, it's one of the most important things in RF, but it's not by any means the only one. And then we'll hopefully get through to Maxwell's equation, but it's a big lecture, so we'll see how we go. Righto, in the last lecture we spoke about charge as our introduction to electrostatics, and we started with a point charge, and we have Coulomb's law for a point charge. So if Q is positive, the electric field is radial and points outward from the charge, and varies inversely as the square of the distance, and there's a fundamental constant there. So for given a charge in free space, you can now calculate its electric field. Okay, we all sort of clear on that? You've probably seen it before, yeah? Okay. Then I went on to a slightly more general law, Gauss's law, and this is actually the first of Maxwell's equations. I'll summarise them when we get to the end, if we do, today. Now, there's the law. That integral, E dot dA, is over a closed sphere, a closed surface, not a sphere at all, surrounding the charge. Q is the sum total of all the charges inside that surface, okay? And so that's a general law for the electric field. It's an integral law. There is a differential version of that law. dV equals rho on epsilon naught, where rho is the charge density. But that's much more useful, actually, than this form. But this form is much easier to picture. And to give you an example of that, I covered the case of a capacitor, which has this little pillbox. So you can see the capacitor plates there. With a positive charge, I've deliberately drawn on the inside of the upper plate and a negative charge on the lower plate. The electric field lines are shown there in turquoise. Applying this law, the electric field outside the capacitor is zero, okay? That's a symmetrical constraint, incidentally, not a physical one here, because the capacitor is finite in extent. But if these plates were infinitely long, there's no way there could be any electromagnetic influence outside, as you'll see in a minute when we cover shielding. And so we have just this electric field on the inside, and the electric field has to be normal to this closed area here, given by a pillbox, if you like, a cylindrical surface. And so the area of the plate there, that area there, is multiplied by E, gives you the charge per unit area multiplied by the area. So sigma is Q, or charge per unit area, okay? Right, and then that formula then allows you to derive this formula here for the electric field inside a capacitor plate, where sigma is the charge per unit area on the plate and epsilon naught is the permittivity of free space. And then I defined electrostatic potential. Electric field is a vector, okay? So it's generally speaking, a function of the coordinates and time. So x, y, z and time, rho theta phi and time, rho theta z and time, depending on whether you're in rectangular, spherical or cylindrical coordinates. So it's a vector, like a fluid flow that points, okay? And it can vary with time. Some of the results we're discussing here, such as this one, apply only when electric field is not varying with respect to time, okay? So the electrostatic potential is simply defined as the integral along some curve, gamma, generally speaking, E dot dl, where E is the electric field in space, and obviously you're integrating along the curve, so you're taking the local value of the electric field in forming this sum. Okay? And gamma is the name, is the curve, and there's a minus sign in there. Since the path can be any which connects the points x1 and x2, there's a theorem in mathematics which says we won't be going into much of the differential calculus or the vector field theory of partial differential equations of electromagnetism. However, this one here is a useful one to remember. The electric field is always given by the gradient of a potential, minus grad phi. And phi itself is not a vector, it's a scalar, and it's just a function of location. And that rather complicated description is actually the basis of Kirchhoff's voltage law, which I'm sure you've all learnt. Charge conservation. Now, this is a fundamental law. This one is not restricted to electrostatics by any means. Charges are conserved, and the way you express that mathematically is through a law like this, in which Q is the time rate of change of charge inside a volume that's bounded by a closed surface A. So we have a volume in space, and there's an area that's the surface area of the bounding volume. If you integrate the current density, which is current in amperes divided per meter squared, which J is interesting because even though current I itself, as you know, it is not actually a vector quantity, J is a vector field just like the electric field. It's a function of X, Y, Z and T. Okay? And it obeys this law. If you integrate J, this is Gauss's law for current, if you like, if you integrate J dot dA over the area bounding this volume, then any charges inside that volume, sum to give you Q, and if the charge is going to change, then current must be escaping. Okay? Q is in coulombs, time in seconds, the current's in amperes. Okay, it's a general law, not just electrostatics. And if current flows around in a closed loop, then of course there need be no change in the current. Okay? If you imagine now that this closed volume is a donut shaped and the current flows completely within the donut around in a circle and never escapes the surface of the donut, that law says that the charge must be conserved. It doesn't change. Okay? And another interesting thing you'll see in your travels, I'll quote, is this formula here. If you have, for example, some real matter, like a solid or metal or plasma or whatever, then quite generally, if you know that the density of charge carriers and their charge, you can calculate the current from MQV. J, remember, is amperes per meter squared. J appears in Maxwell's equations, so it's useful to have a picture of current per area. Now, I remember when I was a student, the biggest problem I had with J was it turned out to be a vector, and yet for some reason, current I in amperes is deprived of the right of being a vector. I couldn't understand that. I thought current had to have direction, it must flow somewhere. But anyway, that's the way it goes. Dielectrics and conductors. Now, this is dealing with the phenomenology of materials, and I'm about to cover all you actually need to know in this course. Dielectrics are insulating materials that don't allow a DC current through them. That's the picture you have of them. They're usually called insulators, like plastic, wood, wool, glass. Most materials are dielectrics. In fact, you can even consider metals to be dielectrics, if you like. We'll get onto that in a minute. In conductors, charge carriers, usually electrons, are free to move. Metals, the best example of those, very important in radio, are metals. We study briefly the phenomenology of these things. Right, here's a dielectric. I think I covered this in the last lecture, but this time I'm recording myself so you can hear it for the rest of your life. Assuming, of course, I don't run out of space on my hard drive. Anyway, dielectrics are insulating materials, as I just said. Electrons and nuclei. Now, imagine no charge carriers free to move. So what happens when you oppose an electric field on a dielectric? You may well think, well, nothing. But it's not quite nothing. Electrons and the nuclei and the atoms and molecules of dielectrics experience opposing forces in the presence of an imposed electric field. In other words, they get dragged by the collar in opposite directions. Electrons move opposite to the field because electrons have negative charge. They go the electric field points that way, the electrons go that way. Protons and positive particles like protons, nuclei, etc., move with the field in the direction of the field. Now that actually is a bit of a... they get budged. And that... state of displacement, if you like, is referred to as polarisation. Now, and that's not to be confused with polarisation of electromagnetic waves, which we'll meet later in the course. This is polarization in a material. The charge separation induced by the field acts to reduce the electric field within the dielectric, and it's sort of easy to see why. If that's an imposed electric field, the electrons are going to get budged that way, and the ions get budged this way, you can see that the electric field caused by the charge now points upwards and partially cancels the electric field. In most of your travels in life, you only need to know about dielectrics, but there are other materials that do the exact opposite. And they're called paraelectric materials. Well, you won't be treating those. All right, polarization. Let's look at it in a bit more detail. The dipole moment, okay, this is how you quantify polarization. First of all, let's break up that big dielectric I have there into this picture here, okay? Each little, it's not necessarily an atom, by the way. If you read an electromagnetic theory textbook, you'll find the description of dielectrics to be somewhat more complicated than what I'm presenting here, but you don't need to know more than what I'm saying here, or in the web notes for that matter. Here is an example of a particle of some kind inside the dielectric. This distance here represents the distance that the electrons and the ions, the negative and positive charges, are displaced from each other. Okay? It's a hypothetical little d that has no physical use for you guys. It's a distance. The electric field, this is the external field imposed, and here you have these positive and negative charges. Well, you define polarization, big P, as the number density of these dipoles. And a dipole is simply a collection of three things: a positive charge, a negative charge, and the distance they've been budged. That's what a dipole is. So we'll look at antenna dipoles later on. They're very similar, same picture. Okay? NQD gives you the formula. Is the formula for P, number density of dipoles times the charge by the distance. Polarization is also a vector quantity, which is useful. And there's a picture of it.
What's the number density?
The number density of these dipoles per unit volume in the material. Okay, this is a bit hypothetical, this presentation, a bit simplified. Because unless you can define what you mean by D exactly, then it's... The reason why I introduce that is so you can see how this is related to a current in a minute. You have a problem?
I don't know, it's just number density. It's not like volume, number per cubic something.
Yes, it is indeed. Oh, sorry, yeah, number density means the number of dipoles per meter cubed. Got me? Okay. Everyone understand that? All right, just remember that for about 5 minutes and then you can probably forget it. All right, now this is the important thing about dielectrics. You see, if you have a uniform dielectric, here's a stack of them right inside a dielectric material. You can see that diagram I just drew. I hope I got the electric field in the right direction and it looks like I haven't. What a nuisance. Sorry, I'll have to fix this up for you guys. I've got the positive charges at the top and the negative ones down the bottom, but otherwise the picture's all right, okay? So there I've drawn those little atoms or little dipoles or whatever they are, okay, inside a dielectric material. Now imagine this, there are billions, there's 10 to the 20 of these that you're looking at here, okay? There's the distances. This P is the overall polarization. Remember, it's a number density of these things. It points in the direction of the imposed electric field, and you can see each of these has been displaced. Okay, right. The surface charge density on the dielectric is given by P dot N. Now, if this is a uniform dielectric, or the electric field is uniform, then all of those positive and negative charges cancel inside the dielectric, okay? You can see that the positive and negatives here lie right on top of one another, and so there's nothing, there's no charge. On the other hand, those charges that have been budged appear on the surface. And so you've probably got the picture from the first diagram I put up anyway, that when you impose an electric field on a dipole, on a dielectric material, charges appear on the surface of the insulator, okay? Not only that, if the electric field's downwards, then the charges appear on these two surfaces and not on these surfaces, okay? And sigma is actually charge per unit area, exactly the same meaning as with the capacitor plate that I just spoke about. But this is a sort of a capacitor plate. And not only that, you may know already that insulators, in radio at least, are mainly used for capacitor plates of some kind, okay? And it's very important to know how to work with them. Rightio, so this normal thing here, n hat, is a unit vector, okay, and it points in a direction normal to the surface, okay? And if you take the dot product with P at that point, just inside the surface, you end up with that charge that's on the surface. And the other thing to notice about sigma P is that it's a property of the dielectric and does not exist in free space by itself. It's a leftover charge from a displaced atom. Okay? Alright, let me just go through quickly now some of the mathematics of dielectrics. This is much more important than the picture, but the picture is useful if you want to understand things. First of all, if E is your imposed electric field, then the polarisation is defined, is given by this, for a linear dielectric, like all the ones you're ever going to deal with, okay? In other words, the polarisation is just proportional to the electric field, and the constant, epsilon R, is referred to as the relative permittivity of the dielectric. It's a property of the dielectric, and it completely characterises everything you ever need to know about that material at radio frequency. And so it's not surprising that radio engineering textbooks, or handbooks, have lots and lots of pages cataloguing dielectric constant as a function of frequency, or wavelength, if you like. This can also be used, P can also be used to define another quantity, D, a vector, called the electric displacement, which has the following use. We'll go into dielectric constant in a bit more in a minute. Oh, the other thing to see is that D simplifies now to become this. So D is very analogous to electric field, whereas if that's epsilon R is equal to 1 for a vacuum, so a vacuum can never have polarisation. Well, that's lucky. Okay. For dielectrics, epsilon R is also greater than 1. I think I say that somewhere. Main advantage of the definition of D is that its source is the free charge only. So you can easily show from Gauss's law that, we had Gauss's law for the electric field before, where this was the total electric field. The integral of D is Q free. Now, what is Q free? Usually Q free represents the charge on metals, actually, or any free charge you can make in space. For example, with an ionised gas, any you can rub off your shirt. As long as it's not, it's better to ask what is not free. What is not free are those dipole charges bound to dielectrics. Okay? I hope when the screensaver goes on that it doesn't stop recording. That would be terrible. Alright. Key points. Alright, here's the key points for what you need to know about epsilon R, because if you know epsilon R, everything about it, you know all you need to know in radio frequency engineering about dielectrics. The relative dielectric constant epsilon R describes the behaviour of dielectric when exposed to an oscillating electric field. Okay, epsilon R at DC, meaning frequency equal to zero, is a positive dimensionless number and is always greater than 1 for dielectrics. That couldn't be easier. However, when the electric field oscillates, epsilon R is a complex function of frequency. Now that's interesting, because if you have a dielectric which has a complex part of epsilon R, can anyone guess what problems that causes? What does it tell you about the dielectric? This is something, a problem you don't have, or you have it with metals as well. It's almost an innate part of metals, actually.
It absorbs,
exactly. It's a lossy dielectric. You have this strange adjective, lossy, L-O-S-S-Y. The dielectric gets hot, and when I was a student, it was pretty hard to imagine dielectrics getting hot, but for you guys, it's easy. Who's ever put their pen in a microwave oven? Just find some plastic. It's getting harder and harder to find those plastics. You'll have to go to something else other than a plastic. But if it ain't microwave proof, then it's probably a lossy dielectric. Okay, has a large imaginary part. Right, now here's an important quantity. This is the tabulated quantity usually for dielectrics. The ratio of the real, the imaginary to the real, I'll fix that, components of an epsilon term, the loss tangent, and it's given by that. That's a function of frequency. At DC, it's always zero. Otherwise, you wouldn't have an insulator. Well, you could have one if you're thinking about carbon or something, but certainly not Teflon, okay? Or PVC even at DC. Alright, conductors. Let's look at conductors. Conductors are easier than dielectrics by a long way, okay? There's only one law for conductors, Ohm's law. Sigma is always a real number. It's never imaginary. But not for conductors. And it doesn't matter what conductor you talk about, lead, uranium, copper, gold, silver, certainly copper and silver being the most, and gold being the most common ones you'll see in radio, they're the ones with the highest conductivity sigma. And what a strange unit it has. If you check, sigma's actually related to a quantity that you're quite familiar with. You know, resistance, we'll see, you've probably seen it already if you read the lecture notes, but if you have a metal with an area, a cross-sectional area A, driving a current, the current's going through it like that, and its length is L, then the resistance in ohms of that metal is 1 over sigma times L over A, where L is the length and A is the area. Sigma is the conductivity there. And if you check the units on this, you've got inverse meters here, you can see that conductivity is measured in 1 over ohm meters. And so somebody thought of this idea that instead of writing 1 over ohm meters, just spell ohms backwards. But it's, the plural's wrong, it's not SMO, but it's called mohs per meter. Anyway, that's what its unit is. It's an SI unit, or an MKS unit. So implicitly, it's the one we'll always use. I don't use CG. I never spoke about units, but we don't use CGS units in this course. There are some fields of engineering where people can't help themselves but talk about stat volts and Gauss for magnetic fields, stat volts for electric field. In this course, electric field is always volts per meter, and magnetic field will always be in Tesla, as you'll see. Ohm's law is assumed to be an accurate result for all radio frequencies, and that's not quite true, so that's why I've got the smiley there. But we're not going to cover those strange situations where it's not in this course, so we'll leave it at that. When I say all radio frequencies, I mean up to 300 gigahertz. At light frequencies, it sort of becomes untrue. But sigma is always a real number and independent of the frequency in this course. All right, now conductors versus dielectrics. Let's look at the relationship between them. We have some simple laws, similar looking laws here. Let's see what we can do with them. We have J equals sigma E for metals. So any electric field that appears in a metal must immediately, without contesting anything, produce a current density J. Right? That's an unstable situation. Metals don't like electric fields because when electric sees an electric field, that produces a current. Okay? That's the way metals are. Dielectrics quite different. When they see an electric field, they get polarized. Like a cat with its hair raised when it feels angry. Okay, they get polarized. Right, we can now take the time derivative of P for an oscillating electric field, and we end up with this law just by multiplying by J omega in a fashion mathematically you've seen before. Now, since these dipoles are reversing their sign at a rate omega while traversing a distance d, this J omega P is actually a current in the dielectric now. Now you can see why it is that dielectrics can get hot in a microwave oven, right? They actually carry a current at 2.4 gigahertz. And if they offer any resistance to that current, they'll cook. In fact, that's how food cooks. But that's not how you want your container to react, okay? So you've got this current, polarization current is what it's called, and it's not a free current either, for the same reason that the charges that produce it in the dipoles are not free. And so this gives you a sort of an Ohm's law looking thing. It's all right to call it sort of an Ohm's law. To a plasma physicist, it's the only Ohm's law. Plasmas behave like this with a very complicated epsilon R. But you just multiply J omega by that, and all of a sudden we have something that looks like Ohm's law. Rightio? So at the end of the day, if you're an electromagnetic theorist, you don't care about metals and dielectrics. They're all the same. It's just a question of what you're going to call sigma. And the main difference between conductors and insulators is simply that sigma is resistive. It's a real number for a conductor, but it's usually reactive for a dielectric. In other words, you can see there's a 90 degree relationship between epsilon R and sigma, or epsilon R minus 1, that residual electromagnetic effect. All right? And as I said before, epsilon is a complex number, displaying both loss as well as reactive behaviour. Right, now, if you have a good intuition of Gauss's law and Ohm's law, we're going to look at electromagnetic shielding. Ohm's law for the and Gauss's law give rise to the concept of electromagnetic shielding. It's pretty important at radio. We'll just cover the main principles about it here. And here's our model, if you like, our view of this system. Oh, that is... Okay. Suppose there is an isolated positive charge, that's the red plus sign here, inside a cavity of a conducting box that is floating, not connected to Earth. That's what floating means, and neutral, that has no net charge in its own right. So it's a pretty funny looking box. It's actually an ellipse, because that's easy to draw with open office, whatever you call it. Okay, so I drew a couple of ellipses. This turquoise region here is supposed to be the metal, that's the conductor, and then there's a hole in it that got there somehow, and a positive charge that got there even more questionably, okay? But anyway, it's there. These yellow things here are minus signs representing electrons, and these other red pluses are positive charges, okay? And the little... These are actually green arrows, light green arrows, pointing outward, representing electric field. And we have similar light green arrows in there. Now, I've drawn that pretty much true to scale. So let's see what we can deduce from that picture, if you can just keep that in your heads for a while. The electric current is finite at the best. If that were an oscillating situation, there would be some current around the place. If it's static, there's nowhere for current to flow in the DC situation with that big lump of spherical metal that I have there. Is everyone following this? So Ohm's law says that J equals sigma E. Well, if sigma is gigantic enough, and J is and the frequency and and we're talking about a static situation, then the current's actually zero, okay? Right, so that means that the electric field has to be zero from J equals sigma E. If we've got a time-varying situation, then sigma is large, and that gives rise to a small electric field at best, okay? So if it's a good conductor, nowhere inside that conductor can you have a finite electric field. Is that clear to everyone? Okay? Just imagine the static situation where nothing's changing. That diagram I just showed you there is actually fixed in time. That's fixed in time. Then J equals sigma E inside here. And sigma is finite because it's a conductor. In an insulator at DC, sigma is infinite. Right? You can check it from that equation I put up there. In this case, the electric field has to be zero, because if J equals sigma E, okay, and J is zero, the electric field is zero, and if this varies even with time, if sigma is very large, then E will also be small, okay? So that's the first observation. Is it all right? Electric fields are always zero inside conductors, is the rule I'm going to deduce from it. Okay? Right, Gauss's law implies that the net negative charge on the inside of the inner wall of the cavity is equal and opposite in sign to Q. Why is that? Sorry? Yes? Not conservation here. Gauss's law implies that the net negative charge. Remember, Gauss's law said that the integral of the electric field over a surface area, right, is equal to the charge on the inside. But now imagine that we have a surface that's inside the conductor. The electric field's zero, isn't it? Anywhere inside that conductor, the electric field is zero. So if you choose the closed surface in Gauss's law to be just outside that cavity there, then there can't be any charge on the inside because the electric field's zero, right? Remember this law? I'll write it up, maybe in more eloquent. Put a circle on that. I'll call that the sum of all the charges, right? Right, integral of E dot A. Let that A, this surface that we're doing this integral over, let it be a surface that's just surrounding that little hole, that cavity. But inside the metal. If it's inside the metal, the electric field's zero, so the sum of all these charges must be zero. But we've already got a charge inside there anyway. Plus one we put there, somehow got there. And so all those electrons, the sum of all their charges must equal Q. Must perfectly cancel it because electrons have the opposite sign of charge to, whatever these charges are. If that had been negative, then electrons would have been pushed to the outside and you would have had positive charge on the inside. No matter what, the sum of charges is zero. Okay? Have we got that? Everyone got that. Do you understand that now? Remember, yeah, these equations have now wandered up onto the top view graphs and you can't see them anymore. But if you look over the lectures afterward and you listen to my voice, if you have time, then it should come back to you. All right, so we have two things so far. Electric field zero. The charge on the cavity is equal and opposite to that on contained. Charge conservation now implies that the amount of positive charge on the outer surface equals the negative charge on the inner surface. Right? Remember, I said that this thing was neutral to start with, this conductor. So if you steal some negative charges here to satisfy Gauss's law, and the electric field's everywhere zero, then you must push the charge, positive charges, to the outer surface of the metal. Why do they live on the outer surface? Can they live inside the conductor, do you think? Who can see why that Gauss's law prevents that from happening? Imagine what would happen if at least even one of those positive charges was on the inside. Sorry? Yeah, there would be. Why? Yes, exactly. Now let that surface area, right? You're free to choose A where you please. Let's put this positive charge, say, there. Now we've just said that if the sum of all these charges cancels this one perfectly, if I put a positive charge there, then the integral of the electric field over the area encompassing the positive charge at mid-radius here is now non-zero. And that can only be if the electric field is non-zero. That contradicts the fact that the electric field has to be zero inside a conductor. Finished. And so the conclusion there is that all the positive charges live on the outside. No, they're right on the surface. Yeah, that's a good point. Hey, I didn't actually draw that very well, did I? The positives I put on the outside, but the negatives I should have put on the inside in the hole. Because they're not actually in the vacuum, of course, they're sitting right on the surface of that conductor. And that's an extremely interesting result, because when a conductor has finite conductivity, you cannot completely expel the electric field by Ohm's law. Okay, you can have some currents flowing around, of course, but the electric field doesn't cancel, and But electric fields are attenuated as they go inside metals until they're eventually negligible when you dig enough into a metal. That's an effect called skin effect, you may have heard of. We'll cover that later on. However, in a static situation, or in any situation for that matter, all charge must exist, net charge must exist on the surface of any conductor, regardless of frequency. I haven't proven that here, because I'm only considering a static case, but it's generally true. Right on the surface they are. And that creates a bizarre situation. Well, what if it's a human who's charged up like this? Because you've got dry skin and a conducting inner. The answer is it causes devastating effect. I think I'll remark on it in a minute. But does that answer your question? You're actually right. They're drawn incorrectly. There, those yellow things must be on right on the inside surface here.
Okay, right on there.
They have to be, just like these ones are correctly drawn on the outside there. Righto, there are a few more observations about this that you can ponder over. The negative charge arranges itself to give perfect cancellation of the electric field inside the conductor. Now, I've proven that the negative charge is equal and opposite to the positive charge by Gauss's law, just to give the because we have deduced from Ohm's law that the electric field is zero inside the conductor. But when you think about it, that's tricky to arrange. How does nature arrange that that happens? And the answer is, but those electrons that distribute themselves on the inside surface of a cavity take up special locations to make sure that it doesn't happen. They find, and they always find, a solution to self-locating themselves so that the electric field is banished everywhere inside the conductor. Truly interesting philosophical thought. Very mathematical thought, I think. Everyone get that? Those charges have contrived, even conspired, to make the electric field zero inside that conductor. What we did was use Ohm's law, right? So there's an interesting question that arises out of that. The negative surface charge density is highest on the wall closest to Q. I'll speak about that a bit more in a minute. The positive charges on the outer surface see no electric field inside the conductor, and therefore do not respond to movement in either Q or the negative charge in the cavity. They live in a different world. They only got there because they were left behind. They don't know where the electrons went to, and they just sit there. Okay? The positive charges on the outside bunch towards surfaces of high curvature and spread out along surfaces of low curvature. That's an interesting thing about metals. As I make this more oblate, I think is the word, squash this thing into a cigar, the positive charge density near the ends becomes higher than it does along the flat edges. Okay? And you know that there are applications of that in high voltage. Whenever you look at how Jacob's ladders work and break down, it's always better to have a pin, a high voltage electrode. If you want to make lightning, you need a high voltage generator, like a Tesla coil. But you have a very sharp point, and that's where the electric field's highest, all because E equals sigma over E near over epsilon naught near any conductor. And when sigma gets large, because these bunch toward these high curvature endpoints, electric field also becomes large and eventually breaks down the gas. So that's the last observation there. Oh no, it's not invisible. Right. The charge on the surface of the metal-air interface lies right on the surface and not inside the conductor. That's your question. I was going to get onto it anyway. The charge on the surface of the air, wherever you have an air-metal interface, the charge is right on the surface, not inside it. Okay? And I lead you to ask you to think whether that's what is the cause of RF burns. You know, when you've got badly earthed RF equipment and you touch it, it always gives a nicotine stain after a terrible sting, okay? Because the charges on your finger can't go on the inside. They've got to cross your dry skin no matter what. Dry skin's not conductive. So it's an interesting phenomenon. I don't know if I'm going to experiment too much with it, I hope, in the future. By Gauss's law, that's based. There is still an electric field outside the conductor. That's important. The outside world still feels that charge on the inside. In this case, because these positive charges here give rise to an electric field on the outside. Right, these are important points to think of. If there were no net charge inside the cavity, that original Q were equal to zero, then there'd be no electric field outside the conducting box either, by Gauss's law. Because if you made plus, if you went right back to this figure again and put an additional negative charge in there, then sure, there would be no net negative charge here on the surface, and there'll be no net negative or positive charge on the outer surface. Okay. At the surface of the metal, the electric field vector is always normal. There is never any. Now that's an important point. When it's a fundamental assumption. In fact, it's the only one you need to know when solving these kinds of problems with waves. Whenever an electromagnetic wave hits a metal, the tangential component lying in the plane of the metal is always zero. That's a fundamental assumption. So, but that can be normal. So, what happens? I'll just ask the question to you. Supposing this wall were a metal plane, and I have an electromagnetic wave coming in, and its electric field vector is polarized by that. When it gets to the wall, there can't be any tangential component of the field. What happens? Can anyone tell me what will happen? This is another example of where the mathematics takes away from complicated physics. Sorry? Yes, if you've got an electromagnetic wave, I haven't talked about electromagnetic waves yet, that's the next lecture, but let's just imagine that this is a sinusoidally oscillating electric field vector polarized upward. Remember, electric field is a vector quantity, so it has to point some way. It varies in space and time, and it's oscillating at, say, 1 gigahertz, okay, quite fast. And it propagates in, and this is a metal plate. It hits the wall. We've suddenly got a tangential component of electric field on the wall. Metals don't like that. The charges are now going, the current density inside the wall is going infinite, or very large, because sigma is normally large. So what happens? What does the metal do? In response to that situation, to guarantee that the electric field is always zero on its surface. Exactly. It produces an equal and opposite electromagnetic wave propagating in the opposite direction with an electric field whose vector is completely opposite to that of the incident wave at every point in time. And that causes a reflection, or it's reflection or scattering of electromagnetic waves.
Is there a reason for that? Like, why does it do that?
Why? Unsure. Because the electric field cannot penetrate. You don't want a big law of nature coming in and tidying up where I can see it here. What happens is that the electric field comes into the wall. The first thing that happens is it causes charges to flow inside the metal by Ohm's law. Those charges, the current would be very large that does that, okay? And so when the current starts to flow, it produces its own electromagnetic wave that's 180 degrees out of phase with the electric field of this wave, and there's just a little residual electric field left over trying to penetrate the metal that is enough to overcome the conductivity. If the conductivity is infinite, then nothing will penetrate the wall, okay? And then those currents now become a secondary source for a new electromagnetic wave. They become an antenna that launches a new electromagnetic wave. But it's all right to explain a simple one like that. What's incredible is that every lump of metal in the room, like this thing here, is currently doing it for your mobile phone. And your mobile phone responds to the base station. None of its electric fields penetrate this, and it becomes a secondary emitter for your mobile phone. And that's very interesting. There are a lot of applications, obviously, of mirrors and reflectors in electromagnetism, but you can even have antennas referred to as passive repeaters that actually allow you to re-steer your electromagnetic wave and give a higher energy at some other point, and therefore, for example, for getting electromagnetic waves around corners, you can do that. Just a mirror, okay? Oh, the mirror is the best known example. It's exactly how a light mirror works, okay? Any questions? All right. Yes, this is probably the most important thing you have to take away from here. The tangential component of electric field must be zero at any conductor. Righto, what's the difference now if you earth the box? This is a subtle difference. And actually, in actual fact, everything we've said above now is true. Okay, first of all, the Gauss's law still applies inside the conductor, so these are negative charges are equal and opposite to the positive charge still. Now, the interesting thing about it now, that's not there before, is that these positive charges, which were left behind by these electrons, now have an infinite source of electrons to suck up and neutralise them from Earth. That's what Earth means. Earth means, radio Earth is easy because it just has to be big enough, a big lump enough metal that your circuit, your little circuit, can't possibly draw enough charges out of it to vary the electric fields in the environment. Okay, so Earth is an infinite source of charge. So these positive charges now draw up electrons. Anybody standing outside would never know that there was a positive charge on the inside. Okay? All right, let's just take a closer look at what happens when you put a positive charge near a metal. A charge near a conducting surface attracts charge of the opposite sign to the nearest point on the surface. So here's a positive charge, this is a conductor, and these yellow things are electrons. Now I've drawn them correctly on the surface, okay? The green things are the electric field lines. I drew these electric field lines making ellipses, and so for some reason, in order to make it look realistic, they're not actually normal, but I've drawn all these little green arrowheads here normal to the surface, okay? Now, those charges on the surface here distribute themselves to make the tangential electric field zero, okay? And because there's no tangential field, the normal field of electric field terminates on these negative charges, and there's nothing on the inside. However, a useful mathematical construct sometimes, particularly if this surface here has a nice geometry, is that this electric field here can be calculated by assuming that this positive charge has a negative, equal and opposite negative charge on the inside, referred to as an image. Then you can calculate the electric field. To calculate the electric field in the presence of the conductor, you remove the conductor, put a positive there, negative charge is at an equal distance below the conducting surface as the positive charge is above, and you can calculate the electric field from that. Okay, I might make that an exercise to show you can do it. But that's the picture you have, you see. And the closer is that positive charge to the surface, the larger are these negative charges. It's the charge density. And the electric field increases dramatically because, remember, Coulomb's law says that the electric field varies as 1 over r squared. Question?
You said you can read the electric field outside the conductor, but
If it's Earth, it makes no difference to this conductor. I am assuming that it's large enough so that this distance here is much smaller than the width, or otherwise you have to take into account the conductor as a whole and its shape. I'm assuming this. When you get a charge gets close to a conductor, eventually it always looks like this drawing, right? Because if you're one tenth of a millimetre from the corner of that conducting projector pole there, it looks like that. At 0.1 of a millimetre distance, it looks like this. And so you can always use this idea when you're close enough to measure. And it makes no difference if it's Earth or not, because the only objective of that positive charge is to make sure, or of these negative charges, I mean, is to make sure there's no electric field inside the conductor. That's all. If other charges inside that conductor are deprived of electrons, in order to make that happen, so be it. If they can be neutralised by sticking an earth on it, then that's fine too, but you don't change this rule, okay, by doing that. Now, as this positive charge approaches here, because of the 1 over r squared variation of the electric field in Coulomb's law, the electric field increases significantly as this approaches here, okay? And of course you have a dead short for that charge when it hits the conductor. All right. Here's a related phenomenon. I might be stretching to talk about this now. And this is the proximity of floating conductors. Right, so imagine we have two charges, and we can think of those as being electronic components near a floating conductor. Okay? Now, if these are the positive charges here, okay? And this is a conductor, gone grey for some reason, used to be turquoise, and this is a positive charge, okay? And these positive charges here are a long way from each other. They don't see each other under normal conditions, but they're right near the surface of this metal. Now they have to share the charge within the conductor. Electromagnetic fields at opposite ends of the plane cause charge separations that increase the influence of the component on each other. Now, suppose you brought this guy up here, then these electrons here are only there to prevent the electric field from being zero inside the conductor. And same over here. But because these were both positive charges, they've left behind positive charges all over the place. And so what happens is, particularly these charges here, alter the electromagnetic fields in the space surrounding these two charges in such a way that they feel one another more than they would without the floating conductor. Okay? Now, let's consider what happens when we earth the plane. When you earth the plane, those positive charges are free to go where they like. So they attract up more electrons and it's all over. The only thing that's left now is that these positive charges still need these electrons to prevent electric fields from appearing within the conductor. But now there are no electric fields outside in addition to those caused by these. Okay, and because these, from over here, this thing here looks like positive charge right on top of a negative charge. In effect, this has been shielded from here and vice versa. So these are less influenced by their proximity to each other when this conductor's earthed compared to when it's not earthed. Okay? These are little tricks that are going to arise, okay, when you look at using conducting planes. Who can tell me what the big conducting plane is going to be in this course? You probably don't realise it actually yet. Your circuit board, simply. Because whenever you do radio frequency design on a circuit board, you always have an uninterrupted conducting plane. It's a fundamental rule, okay? Oh, magnetostatics, good place to stop. Okay, so if there are any questions, email me, anything.